Hey, this is Brian Zond, and I'm glad that you're interested in the podcast. You know, it's a free podcast, and it'll always be that way. But if you would like to give and help us out, that would be awesome, deeply appreciated. If you want to do that, you can do that through the Word of Life website or through the Word of Life mobile app. Anyway, God bless you. I hope you enjoy the podcast. Today, we're going to meet Jesus again, and my sermon is entitled Lazarus, Raskolnikov, and You. All shall become plain in due time. John arranges his majestic, poetic, theological gospel around seven signs. This is the framework, the narrative structure of the Gospel of John, is that we move from sign to sign. And the seventh of the seven signs is the raising of Lazarus, a man who had been dead 4 days. Now, strangely, this event of raising Lazarus from the dead intensifies the murder plot against Jesus that is already brewing among the Sanhedrin. And there's a reason for this. I mean, Caiaphas, the high priest, was an intelligent and shrewd man. And he knew that a man who can wake the dead, that man can build a powerful movement. And Caiaphas actually tells us what his anxiety is. He says, what's going to happen is there's going to be an uprising against our Roman occupiers around Jesus, and then Rome will come and destroy the city and destroy the temple, and we'll lose everything. Caiaphas says that. Now, the thing is, Jesus was not plotting a violent revolution against Rome. But nobody seemed to understand that. Neither Jesus' followers nor his enemies really thought that. They all thought eventually he'll turn to violence. But Jesus was never going to do that. He was going to become king in a whole new way. But people didn't understand that. Ironically, 40 years later, as Jesus prophesied, this is exactly what happened. They rose up, the Jews, in violent revolution against Rome, and the Romans came, destroyed the city, destroyed the temple, and they lost everything. Well, the last time Jesus had been in Jerusalem, he had narrowly escaped being stoned to death. You might remember that story from John 8, where the woman caught in adultery is brought to him. Their intention is to stone her. Jesus intervenes. They don't stone her, but by the time you get to the end of the chapter, they're now ready to stone him. So Jesus, at this point, retreats into the wilderness east of the Jordan, awaiting for the final showdown with the principalities and powers in Jerusalem that will come at Passover. But then something happens that draws Jesus out of his wilderness seclusion back into the dangers of Judea. And it involves his friends. Jesus had friends. I don't know if you think in terms of that, but Jesus had friends. He had disciples. They were friends. But he had people that he just regarded as friends, that he liked to hang out with, that he liked to be with, that he was comfortable around. And among his friends were Lazarus and his sisters, Martha and Mary. They lived in Bethany, which is at the top of the Mount of Olives, just 2 miles from Jerusalem. And it seems that this is where Jesus stayed when he would come to Jerusalem. He would be a guest in the home. They were apparently somewhat wealthy. He would be a guest in the home of Lazarus and Mary and Martha. And of course, there's numerous stories in the Gospels involving these three friends of Jesus. Well, while Jesus is in seclusion in the wilderness because of the murder threats against him, east of the Jordan, Lazarus falls ill. Mary and Martha, because they're friends, they're part of that inner circle, they know where he is. Not everybody knew. The Sanhedrin didn't know, but they knew. And so they sent a messenger from their home in Bethany, where Lazarus was gravely ill, to Jesus. And the message was simply this: the one whom you love is very sick. Jesus responded to this message by saying, "This sickness is not unto death, but for the glory of God." And he stayed there 2 more days. After 2 days, Jesus said cryptically to his disciples, "Our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep. I need to go wake him up." And so he traveled from his seclusion in the wilderness east of Jordan back to Judea, to Bethany, to the home of Lazarus and Mary and Martha. When they hear that Jesus is coming, first Martha rushes out to meet him. Then Mary will do the same thing, and they both have the same complaint. "Oh, Lord, if you had been here, our brother would not have died." Martha and Mary are frustrated. They're upset with Jesus because he failed to act when they first called upon him. Hello. Anybody ever experienced something similar? That you were in the worst possible situation that you knew. Jesus, if he would just show up and do something, could fix it. You know that too. So you call out to him, and he takes his own sweet time about it. Doesn't show up on time, at least the way you're telling time in the present moment. Well, this is what happens to Martha and Mary. When Jesus finally arrives there, into the village, at the home, near where they have buried Lazarus, he just sees the overwhelming grief. I was at a cemetery yesterday. It wasn't as sorrowful as this because it was the funeral for my uncle, my dad's brother, who was 84. He'd lived a long life, and so that was a consolation. But I was very glad that at the cemetery there in Savannah, the chaplain read the story that we're looking at today from John chapter 11. Well, Jesus was there at the site of where they buried people, a cemetery. And that's when we're told Jesus wept. A man of sorrows, acquainted with grief. He feels their pain. He knows the sorrow that death has wrought, and it brings him to tears. The tomb was a cave. That was what was typically used. Jesus would be buried in a rich man's tomb that had been newly hewn out of the rock. But most of the time, it was natural caves that were used that they would then put a stone in front of. And so Jesus said, "Show me the place. Take me there." And they take him to where Lazarus has been buried. He's been dead 4 days now. It's a cave with a stone rolled across the mouth of the cave. And Jesus says, "Take away the stone." And there's anxiety. There's hesitation. Martha says, "You know, it's been 4 days. By now there'll be an odor. You sure you want to do this?" And Jesus says, "If you believe, you will see the glory of God. Take away the stone." And they did. And Jesus prays a brief prayer and then lifts up his voice and says, "Lazarus, come out." And Lazarus, still bound in the grave clothes, comes back to life. The artwork that we've selected for today's sermon is a 12th century Byzantine icon. The original is found today in the Byzantine Museum in Athens, Greece. But it's just a common icon. We have no idea who the iconographer was. It's just a common icon from the time period. What makes this one a bit unique is instead of using the gold background, which was typical of Byzantine icons, to convey the idea of a otherworldly, eternal setting, the iconographer has used the more easily obtained and cheaper red pigment. It's just an acknowledgement that funds were tight and they couldn't use the gold like they usually do, and so he opted for this red pigment, but it makes it unique and interesting to us. And in this icon, of course, Jesus is central. The icon was, like as all icons are, is painted on wood, and that's what you see in our reproduction of it. You see where the pigment has worn away. You see the wood there shining through. So in the icon, Jesus is central. At the left side of the icon, we have Andrew and Peter. And then at the feet of Jesus, we have, this is Mary, and that's Martha. And now we have Lazarus, 4 days dead, coming back to life, and some of those standing by are beginning to unwind him. This is a 900-year-old icon. We've been telling this story for a very long time. In the Gospel of John, what matters most is not the miracle, but the sign it points us to. It's the sign. It's what it points us to. In fact, John never uses the word miracle in his gospel. He always calls them signs. And the sign of Lazarus, which is the seventh sign, points to this truth that in no life is it a lost cause. That if Jesus is present, no life is a lost cause. No matter how hopeless it seems, no matter how far gone, the sign of the raising of Lazarus points us to this truth that with Jesus, no one is a lost cause. So that a Lazarus has entered into our collective Western imagination, vocabulary, vernacular. If I just say Lazarus, you kind of, oh yeah, that's someone that's come back. That's someone that was lost. That was someone that was given up for dead and somehow they came back. I mean, we can use it seriously. More often you might hear it in a more lighthearted manner. You might hear it in sports conversation. Some team that was so far down that everybody given up hope, but like Lazarus, they came back. The story of Lazarus abides among us through the gospel as a story of enduring hope despite all odds. When all seems lost, when all hope has faded, we remember the story of Lazarus. And because Jesus is the resurrection and the life, now, no matter how mired in sin and death, how stuck in sorrow and despair, no one is a lost cause. And I'm preaching to you. I'm preaching to you. I understand that sometimes it's overwhelming. By this time there's a stench. By this time my hopes are so dashed that it just stinks. I mean, there was a time if Jesus had intervened earlier, I could see myself somehow turning things around, but it's way beyond that now. And I'm here to preach to you and say to you that Jesus hasn't given up. And Jesus has showed up right on time, even though I sympathize with your feelings that it doesn't seem that way. Jesus is showing up, and if you will believe, you will see the glory of God. If you will believe, you will see the glory of God. Now, the sign of the raising of Lazarus is worth honoring with our best artistic efforts. John tells this story in his gospel in a theologically creative and artistic way. The iconographer has reproduced the seventh sign of John's gospel in a beautiful, creative, artistic way as an act of worship, because all creation of icons are an act of worship. And now I want to turn to good old Fyodor Dostoevsky, the greatest literary artist of modern time. And I want to show you what he does with the story of Lazarus. First of all, a bit of background. Some of you may be familiar with his story, but many of you won't be. Fyodor Dostoevsky, born 1821 in St. Petersburg, Russia. Of course, he's gifted, he's intelligent, he's a writer. And at age 27, this is during Tsarist Russia, okay? And he got involved with an intellectual group of people who were privately beginning to verbalize, maybe do some clandestine writing, some criticism of the Tsarist regime. Well, this is dangerous. It got him in trouble. Fyodor Dostoevsky and his other intellectual friends were arrested, put in the St. Peter and Paul prison. They were there for a few months, and they were sentenced to be executed. On the day of their execution, they were brought forth to the parade grounds. Their crimes were read out. The Tsar's sentence of death was pronounced. They were blindfolded. A firing squad was assembled. They went through all of the ritual. And as the order was given for the rifles to be raised, at the last moment, a horse came galloping into the parade grounds. And the rider is shouting, "Halt, halt, halt! The Tsar has commuted the sentence to 4 years hard labor in Siberia, 4 years exile." And Dostoevsky would write about this for the rest of his life. He knew his life was over. He knew that in the next second, the guns would fire, he would be dead, and suddenly his life is given back to him. And it said it awakened him. This is my life, and it's suddenly given back to me. He was immediately put in irons on his feet that he would live with for the next 4 years. He bore scars upon his body for the rest of his life from that. Put in a sled. It was winter. He got severe frostbite on the journey into Siberia. And when he arrived at the prison in Siberia, and he writes about what life was like, and it was not nice. He writes about it in his book, House of the Dead. And as he was going into the prison, he was handed a copy of the New Testament. And for 4 years, it's the only thing he had to read was the New Testament. And it awakened his dormant Christian faith. And although Dostoevsky had written quite successfully prior to his imprisonment, after his 4 years imprisonment, hard labor, misery and suffering, 4 years exile in Siberia, when he begins to write again, he's changed, and it comes forth in his writing. And in one way or another, all of his masterpieces that come after that somehow profoundly involve the gospel of Jesus Christ. I've had people tell me that during the Soviet era, there were several spiritual revivals that broke out among Russian intellectuals. And I said, well, how can this be? You know, the Bibles have all been confiscated, the churches have been shut down, it's illegal to preach the gospel. One of them said this: the communists took away our Bibles, but they didn't take away Dostoevsky. And that's how they found the gospel, was through Dostoevsky. In 1866, when he was 45 years old, Dostoevsky published the first of his four great novels. Now, he has lots of other novels, but he has four. They're like the Mount Rushmore of literary achievement. And the first is Crime and Punishment, then The Idiot, then Demons, then his supreme masterpiece, The Brothers Karamazov. But in 1866, he publishes Crime and Punishment. The central character is a fellow named Raskolnikov, thus the title of the sermon. Lazarus, Raskolnikov, and you. Raskolnikov is an intelligent, young, impoverished university student in St. Petersburg. He basically is an atheist. He certainly has an atheistic, if not nihilistic, philosophy. He believes that life has no meaning. He begins to experiment with dangerous ideas. One of the ideas that comes into Raskolnikov, living in poverty as a university student in St. Petersburg, is that exceptional men are beyond good and evil. Of course, Beyond Good and Evil is the title of a book by Friedrich Nietzsche. That the supermen are beyond good. Good and evil, you know, those constructs are for the little people. But for the great ones, they're bigger than to be measured by good and evil. These are thoughts that he begins to have. These are nihilistic thoughts that are part of the thinking of the day. And Raskolnikov, and part of the genius of this book, is how you are brought inside his head. It's a psychological thrill. You are inside the head of this young man. And be warned, if you read this, it will give you nightmares. I promise you it will. It'll trouble you, but maybe it's worth it. And Raskolnikov is thinking to himself, and he gives the example. He says, well, great men like Napoleon, the ordinary laws of morality don't apply to them. They're beyond good and evil. And he begins to convince himself that he should be a great man and that he should demonstrate he's a great man by a particular act. And it unfolds over time in his mind. And he decides that he's going to murder an old pawnbroker lady. He thinks that she's worthless, that she's a parasite upon society, that she has money, but she's miserly, she doesn't help anybody. She charges exorbitant interest upon people that are in need. And so he's going to demonstrate to himself that he's a great man by murdering her, and he does. He sneaks into her apartments and murders her with an axe. But then he bungles it. And he's discovered by the old pawnbroker's much younger half-sister, who then, to cover up his crime, he has to murder two. So not just like that, one murder's turned into two. Well, the point is that Raskolnikov is a thoroughly debauched and sinful man. He's truly a lost soul. I mean, this is the epitome of a lost soul, and we're in his head, which is quite remarkable. The rest of the novel is part psychological thriller, part detective story, and part theology of redemption. I'm giving it away, but of course this is, you know, part of our Western tradition heritage. You need to kind of know how these things work out anyway. Rosebud is a sled. In the end, Raskolnikov does find redemption, or at least, I can put it more accurately, he finds the pathway to redemption. And Raskolnikov finds the road to redemption through a young woman named Sonia. Now, Sonia is she's a young woman forced into prostitution because of poverty in order to care for two orphan children. It's a very sad story. But Sonia is a kind of Russian Mary Magdalene who has found redemption in Christ. And now she has a Bible that, coincidentally, was given to her by the younger murdered sister of the old pawnbroker lady. A copy of the New Testament, which, as Dostoevsky describes it, is just like the one that was given to him when he went into prison. Well, they have met. There's something of a friendship there. Although Raskolnikov is very difficult. He has not confessed to her what he's done. But he goes to her apartment one night. And they have this long conversation about life, and it's very serious. And at one point, Sonia confesses that she believes in God, and she believes deeply. And it's why she's not despaired. It's why she still has hope, because of God. And Raskolnikov basically mocks her, makes fun of her. He says that he's an atheist, that there is no God, and that she's foolish to believe such things. Then at one point during their conversation, Raskolnikov notices a book. He doesn't know what it is. Notices a book sitting on her chest of drawers. And Raskolnikov walks over and looks at it, and it is a copy of the New Testament. He picks it up and kind of makes a joke about it. And he says, where's that part about Lazarus, about Jesus raising Lazarus? Where is that part? She thinks that he just wants to make fun of her, so she just gives him kind of a sidelong glance and won't respond. So he starts looking for it himself. And she says, no, it's not. It's in the Gospel of John. You don't know anything. And she takes it away and she finds it. And he says, read it. She says, no, I'm not going to read it to you. Yeah, read it. No. And then he asks her, do you believe it? And a tear comes to her eye and she says, with all my heart. With all my heart, I believe it. Now, little literary analysis here. Do you understand what's going on? Raskolnikov knows that he's as hopeless as a four-day dead man. He is an absolute depraved, lost soul. And though he doesn't want to let on immediately, he's wondering, is there hope for someone like me? Finally, he convinces her to read it. And it's beautiful. Dostoevsky reproduces all of John 11, 1 through 45 in the text. And they pause ever so often and she'll make a comment. Dostoevsky tells us that she stressed that he was 4 days dead. She reads it very dramatically, softly whispering, in fact, with tears in her eyes. And that passage ends like this. This is Sonia speaking. That's all about the raising of Lazarus, she whispered. She closes the Bible. The candle was flickering in the battered candle stand, casting a dim light in the destitute room upon the murderer and the harlot strangely come together over the reading of the eternal book. Such a beautiful, poignant scene. It's a beautiful scene of two lost souls on the road to redemption reading about the raising of Lazarus. Well, eventually, Raskolnikov confesses to Sonia what he has done. And when Sonia hears what Raskolnikov has done in murdering these two women, the first thing she says is, oh, what have you done to yourself? Find that a very interesting comment. Not what have you done, but what have you done to yourself? You see, sin always carries its own punishment. People don't get away with anything. What have you done to yourself? In the end, Sonia persuades Raskolnikov to go to the police and confess his crime. And he does so. And he's sentenced to prison in Siberia. And Sonia, who represents redemption, or really a kind of Christ figure in the book, goes to Siberia with him. She says, I'll go with you. And she's not in prison, but she's going to go there and be near him and visit him and care for him. And it's in Siberia, amidst suffering, as Raskolnikov is softened by his suffering and loved by Sonia, that this depraved murderer finds his path to redemption. The book ends like this. He's in prison. He's in the gulag. He's in Siberia. He's laying in his bunk. Under his pillow lay the New Testament. He took it up mechanically. The book belonged to Sonia. It was the one from which she had read the raising of Lazarus to him. Remember, this is the one that was given to Sonia by the younger sister that was murdered. This is all coming full circle. At first, Raskolnikov was afraid that Sonia would bother him about religion and talk about the gospel and pester him with books. But to his great surprise, she had not once approached the subject and had not even offered him the testament. He had asked for it himself, and she brought it to him without a word. Till now he had not opened it, and he did not open it now. But one thought passed through his mind. Cannot her belief be mine now? Cannot her belief be mine now? He did not know that the new life would not be given to him for nothing, that he would have to pay dearly for it, that it would cost him great striving, great suffering. But that is the beginning of a new story. The story of the gradual renewal of a man. The story of his gradual regeneration. Of his passing from one world into another. Of his initiation into a new and unknown life. That might be the subject of a new story. But our present story is ended. What a beautiful story. This is what we believe and confess as Christians. That when the story of Christ gets weaved into our own story, it begins a brand new life. A brand new story. So that we indeed become one raised from the dead. We are, when we believe in Christ, Lazarus raised from the dead. We are Raskolnikov, redeemed by Christ. So whether it's the hopelessness of Lazarus or the shame and guilt of Raskolnikov that lies upon you today, Jesus calls to you and says, come out. And he calls you by name and he says, come out. Just come out of that. And when Jesus says it, you have faith to believe it, and you can begin to move toward Jesus. I mean, we do, I assume, see the volition and the will and the participation of Lazarus in the story. Lazarus can't raise himself from the dead any more than you or I can. But the moment Jesus says, Lazarus, come out, now he has a choice. He could just say, oh, I'll just lay here in this tomb. I'll just stay here in the realm of death. Or he can say, Jesus has spoken. I'm going to move toward him. And he gets up and he comes and everything's not perfect. He's still bound. But Jesus speaks again and said, all right, unbind him, loose him, and let him go. Jesus is calling you by name today out of your hopelessness, out of your shame, out of your despair, out of your guilt, calling you by name saying, come out. And let yourself believe that if you will simply move toward Jesus, it's the beginning of a new life, a new story. Amen. Lazarus, Raskolnikov, you. Amen. Stand with me.